Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. The U.S. and Russia call an emergency teleconference. The topic, how to avoid military encounters as each side wages air campaigns over Syria. Moscow insists it is targeting IS militants, while U.S. officials and others cast doubt on the claim, saying the Russians appear to be attacking rebel groups fighting forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter.
One of the reasons why the Russian position is contradictory is that exactly the potential for them to strike, as they may well have, in places where, in fact, ISIL is not present. Others are present. And this is one of the reasons why the result of this kind of action will inevitably simply be to inflame the civil war in Syria.
Today's discussions were precipitated by Moscow's launch of airstrikes yesterday and again today in Syria, but there are now signs Russia is preparing to expand its operations in the air to neighboring Iraq. A senior Russian diplomat said his country will consider airstrikes in Iraq if Baghdad asks. Afghan officials say its forces have recaptured parts of the northern city of Kunduz from Taliban fighters after what they say has been heavy fighting. Interior Ministry spokesman Sadiq Siddiqui told VOA that Afghan forces launched an offensive overnight and that it was very successful. Residents in Kunduz told reporters earlier today that Afghan security forces were in control in the city, but the Taliban, which seized Kunduz on Monday, insist its fighters are still in control. Greek authorities have opened a disused Olympic venue to house more than 400 migrants camping out in Athens' Victoria Square. Police on Thursday escorted buses carrying migrants, many from Syria and Afghanistan, to Galatsi Hall, home to table tennis and gymnastic competitions in 2004. This is VOA News. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the UN General Assembly today, telling those nations who spoke out in favor of the Iran nuclear deal, check your enthusiasm at the door. This deal doesn't make peace more likely, according to Netanyahu. He said giving Iran billions of dollars in sanctions relief makes the war more likely.
70 years after the murder of 6 million Jews, Iran's rulers promised to destroy my country, murder my people, and the response from this body, the response from nearly every one of the governments represented here, has been absolutely nothing. Utter silence. Deafening silence.
Mr. Netanyahu says Israel will not allow Iran to break in, sneak in, or to walk in to the nuclear weapons club. In the space of a few months, the foundations of the European Union have been rocked by twin crises, the political crises sparked by Greece's economic woes and the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, some analysts say the EU now faces an existential threat.
30 years ago, 5 EU states signed the Schengen Agreement that created a passport-free travel zone, which has since expanded across 26 European states. But that core EU principle of freedom of movement is being tested as several countries reintroduce border checks to counter the migrant surge. Hungary has built razor wire fences along its southern borders. That was surprising, says James Kerlinsey of the London School of Economics.
This idea of free movement, that you'd have open borders, and to see it, these fences going up, I think that this came as a very real shock.
On the horizon lie yet more threats. Britain will hold a vote on leaving the EU before 2018, with recent opinion polls favouring an exit. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
More than 2,000 years after her death, the Egyptian Antiquities Minister is promising authorities to move quickly to get necessary radar equipment to search for Queen Nefertiti's tomb amid a new theory that it could be in a hidden chamber behind King Tutankhamun's tomb. The theory, presented by British Egyptologist Nicholas Reeve, speculates that King Tut, who died at the tender age of 19, may have been rushed into an outer chamber of what was originally intended to be the Queen's tomb. The tomb, either way, is located in the Valley of the Kings near the ancient city of Luxor. The minister says the radar equipment could be obtained and at the site within 3 months. He told reporters in Cairo today plans are being finalized and well in time. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Over the last year, more than 60 million people have been forced from their homes. Desperate conditions are compelling people around the world to move. The Syria crisis is a tragic and dramatic illustrations of this.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon talking about the migrant crisis in Syria and Europe. Details coming up.
Also, the general who led an unsuccessful coup in Burkina Faso is reported to be in the custody of the government. And a fresh wave of violence in the capital of the Central African Republic kills at least 36 people and displaces 30,000 more.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the general who led an unsuccessful coup in Burkina Faso is reported to be in the custody of the government. A defense ministry spokesman announced General Gilbert Diendere had been holed up in the Vatican embassy in Ouagadougou, but said he was willing to face justice for his actions. General Gilbert Diendere led units of his presidential guard in a September 16th effort to overthrow interim president Michel Kafando. Military loyal to the government put down the coup attempt this week. The planned October 11th national election of a permanent government is being rescheduled.
The foreign minister of the Central African Republic has asked the United Nations to increase the size of its peacekeeping force as renewed sectarian violence threatens their capital city. Samuel Ramba told the General Assembly yesterday that Bangui has seen a horrendous spike in displaced people. Chaos returned to the capital over the weekend when more than 40 people died in clashes between Christian anti-Balaka and Muslim Seleka militias. Two peacekeepers were wounded in clashes with militias, and the Red Cross is not able to reach the wounded in some neighborhoods. Ramba requested more peacekeepers and the lifting of restrictions on the training and equipping of his country's military. The Central African Republic was racked by more than a year of violence that began in 2013. Yesterday, Interim President Catherine Samba Panza rushed home from the UN meeting in New York to deal with the unrest that threatens an October 18th national election.
A fresh wave of violence in the capital of the Central African Republic has killed at least 36 people and displaced 30,000 more. A top question now is whether the CAR will push back the October 18th elections to later this year. Katerina Hoye reports from Bamako.
Transitional authorities in Dakar had been warning of an election delay even before a new wave of violence began last Friday. France is against the postponement, while the UN is calling for polls by the end of the year. International Crisis Group analyst Thibault Lesser says a vote on the current conditions is unrealistic and would only add fuel to the fire with the risk of increasing tensions.
Well, if elections are organized now, I think the risk is also the acceptance of the armed groups of the electoral process. So they will, of course, try to disturb this process so the population won't be able to vote freely and again in a safe environment.
The fighting was triggered by the killing of a motorcycle taxi driver in Bangui's mostly Muslim neighborhood of PK5. Muslims sought revenge against Christians in other neighborhoods.
Last event in Bangui, the last traumatic event in Bangui, that it shows very clearly that intercommunal tensions are still very strong there. And not only in the center of the country, but also in the capital city. It happens in a specific political sequence, because there's elections to be organized only at the end of the year, at the end of 2015. So, of course, it's a way for some armed groups leader to try to put a pressure on the authorities and try to enter in kind of a political bargaining with them.
With more than 360,000 people displaced within Dakar, polls will be a logistical challenge. nearly 500,000, most of them Muslims or refugees in neighbouring countries. Remy Jamus, a local journalist and human rights activist, says that for elections to be credible, people need to be able to vote. Politicians need to be able to campaign. This is not possible as many areas are still controlled by armed groups. Transitional authorities, together with 12,000 UN peacekeepers and 1,000 French troops, have struggled to calm tensions over the past year, and it is unclear what more could be done in the months ahead as disarmament efforts have stalled. The ex-Leka rebels, who ousted former President François Bozize in 2013, still control territory, primarily in the north. They called for reinforcements in Bangui this week, as anti-Balaka there began rallying fighters from around the country. Interim President Catherine Samba Panza blames Bozize and other politicians for rallying the militias, accusing them of an attempted coup. The armed groups have little interest in changing the status quo. Analysts predict tensions will remain high at least until polls are held. This is Katarina Höje for VOA News in Bamako.
The United Nations held a high-level meeting yesterday on the migrant and refugee crisis. It's the worst displacement since World War II. The meeting was chaired by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
Over the last year, more than 60 million people have been forced from their homes. Desperate conditions are compelling people around the world to move. The Syria crisis is a tragic and dramatic illustration of this.
He described migration and refugee flows as a global challenge. The UN leader called on nations to step up efforts to prevent and stop wars and persecution, which cause people to flee their homelands. Mr. Ban outlined guiding principles to solve the crisis.
Saving lives. The preservation of life must guide all our efforts, from asylum policies to robust search and rescue mechanisms. Second, protection. Refugees have the right to seek asylum in safety. Third, non-discrimination. Migrants and refugees must be treated with dignity and respect. Fourth, preparedness. We must strengthen reception centers and asylum systems to adjudicate the claims. Fifth, responsibility sharing. States must significantly boost the number of refugee resettlement places and share equitably in this effort. Sixth, cooperation. We need much better cooperation between countries of origin, transit, and destination.
The Secretary General also called for the eradication of ruthless criminal networks behind human trafficking and smuggling. Also addressing the UN high-level meeting on migrants and refugees was Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu. He's currently chair of the Global Forum on Migration and Development.
I would like to state the Syrian crisis is a challenging litmus test for all of us. The time has come for us to act together on migration. Turkey stands ready to work in concert with our partners to address this humanitarian catastrophe. No one is immune from its challenges. Therefore, we need to share responsibility for our own future. After all, migrants and asylum seekers are primarily human beings, and they deserve to be treated as such.
He described the situation in Syria, which is driving much of the migrant and refugee crisis.
As Syrian conflict entered its fifth year, 300,000 lives have been lost. 4 million people have sought shelter in the neighboring countries, and more than 7 million people have been internally displaced. The total number of Syrians in Turkey is now over 2 million. In camps, we are hosting close to 260,000 Syrians. In some Turkish cities on the border, now Syrians are more than Turks. In Kilis, for example, we have the percentage of Syrians are 54%, and Turks became minority. I am really proud of my people. Until now, there was no single anti-Syrian or anti-migrant demonstration or protest in Turkey. We embraced our Syrian brothers and sisters as our relatives, as our neighbors. We opened our doors, we opened our hearts, despite of all the failures of international community to solve Syrian crisis, we will continue to follow this policy, humanitarian policy, for our Syrian brothers and sisters.
The Turkish Prime Minister said since arriving in Turkey, Syrian refugees have given birth to 66,000 babies. In all, there are nearly 1 million Syrian children in Turkey, most of them school age. Turkey is providing them with free education. The Prime Minister said hosting the refugees has cost Turkey more than $7.5 billion. However, the international community has donated just $417 million to help Turkey deal with the crisis.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heap, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The general who led an unsuccessful coup in Burkina Faso is reported to be in custody of for the government. And a fresh wave of violence in the capital of the Central African Republic has killed at least 36 people and displaced 30,000 more. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A new decision by a panel of European judges allows governments in the European Union to jail expelled migrants if they try to re-enter the country. The European Union's Court of Justice in Luxembourg has ruled today in favor of the Italian government in a case involving a deported Albanian national who returned to Italy. EU member states are struggling with how to handle unprecedented numbers of migrants who may not receive political asylum. The UN Refugee Agency says many of the more than 500,000 migrants who have reached Europe this year are asylum seekers. By the end of the year, UNHCR is planning for up to 700,000 people seeking safety and international protection in Europe, with possible increases in 2016. The agency is seeking $129 million to help the EU manage asylum and transit issues of migrants from the Middle East and Africa.
President Pierre Nkurunziza of Burundi has announced on state radio and television that all people must turn in any illegal weapons within 1 month or face criminal arrest. Reuters says Mr. Nkurunziza also said a few security officials found to have tortured captives will be punished as criminals. The nation has been in crisis since popular demonstrations against his August re-election. In the capital, Bujumbura, the dead bodies of opposition and government officials alike are sometimes found lying in the streets. The UN human rights chief has warned that escalating killings and arrests may lead the country to return to its bloody past, a 12-year civil war that ended in 2005.
A new report says widespread disagreement over who owns the world's land threatens to undermine development, livelihoods, and cultures. The Rights and Resources Initiative says indigenous peoples and local communities occupy much of the land, but they only have legal rights to about 18% of it, including forest, agricultural areas, and grasslands. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The report, Who Owns the Land?, says 1.5 billion indigenous people and local communities live on 65% of the world's landmass. But governments recognize only a fraction of their claimed land rights. The report warns that gap increases the risk of conflict, environmental degradation, climate change, and cultural extinction. Ilona Coyle is an analyst at the Rights and Resources Initiative.
The disagreement basically revolves around the idea that 1.5 billion people have lived their lives using customary land tenure systems. And what that means is that they have looked at managing their lands as communities. And there's a big gap between that and what national governments actually recognize.
Coyle explains why customary land rights are important.
Customary rights are the rights that come out of communities' practices over generations. Oftentimes, it will be surrounding traditions, surrounding community authorities that the communities recognize. In some African communities, that might be a chef de village or chef de canton.
In other words, a village or district chief. Land ownership, Coyle says, is a matter of human rights.
These communities have lived there for generations. These aren't squatters. These aren't newcomers to land. These are people who have lived in these communities and have managed these lands for generations. They simply do not have the national government's formal recognition.
For example, the report says that only about 2% of the 100,000 hectares of land held by communities of African descent in Colombia's Caribbean region has been formally recognized by governments. In India, just over 1% of forest land under customary tenure systems has been formally recorded and recognized. Much of the 18% of global land that is recognized as owned or controlled by indigenous peoples or local communities is found in just a few countries: China, Canada, Brazil, Australia, and Mexico. Disputes arise when governments allow companies to develop the land or resources without approval of the local communities. The Rights and Resources Initiative report says pressures are increasing as governments issue concessions for forestry, industrial agriculture, large-scale mining, and oil and gas production.
There are some very daunting statistics regarding overlapping concessions in Peru. There have been concessions issued over millions of hectares of land that are claimed by communities for their ownership and control. In Liberia, for example, 75% of the country's land area has been issued for concessions. And that's a huge amount of area, particularly when there are estimates out there that 71% of Liberia is subject to community ownership and control.
In 2013, in Grand Bassa, Liberia, 250 palm oil workers staged a strike in protest, claiming they had not been paid. Reports say as many as 700 trees were burned and machinery damaged. In Cameroon in 2012, the awarding of a 99-year lease to a company for palm oil production caused tensions with the local community. Critics warned of environmental damage and evictions. The Rights and Resources Initiative analyst says the land rights issue needs to be addressed on multiple levels.
There are international instruments out there that can make a difference, and international processes going on. But a lot of change does have to occur at the local level. A lot of this means lobbying within governments, getting the right stakeholders together to push for changes and reforms to property laws, to forest laws, to the laws governing grasslands and wildlife, and making sure that those laws recognize the fact that these communities have lived there for generations and they should be allowed to continue to do so.
Coyle says on the international level, the issue can be addressed in a number of ways. For example, through the new Sustainable Development Goals and the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A health program in Kenya is on track to reach its goal of treating 1,200 women suffering from obstetric fistula. Through the Fistula Foundation's Action on Fistula initiative, 582 women have received life-changing reconstructive surgery in just over a year of launching the three-year program. Lindsay Palazic is program director for Action on Fistula in Nairobi. She says the effort has been so successful, they are taking a look at taking the model to other countries in Africa and around the world. She explained how the program works.
So there are three main components of Action on Fistula here in Kenya, and that's treatment, training, and outreach. So in the first year, we've treated over 655 women. So that means providing life-restoring fistula repair surgery to over 655 women throughout Kenya. We've worked with FIGO, the Federation of International Gynecology and Obstetrics, to certify the first FIGO-accredited training center in Kenya that's based in Eldoret at GynoCare Fistula Center. And at that center, we've now trained 3 Kenyan surgeons newly trained in fistula surgery and are providing them the ongoing support through the duration of the program. And finally, on the outreach side, which is essential to do community outreach to raise awareness about fistula, to help women who are suffering with the condition know that it's treatable and to really reduce stigma so women feel comfortable coming forward.
Can you just give us a little bit of a background on what causes fistula?
Fistula is caused primarily by prolonged obstructed labor. A woman will be in childbirth for a very long time, often many days, without the necessary medical attention that she needs to relieve that obstructed labor. So it happens quite often in places like Kenya and other parts of the developing world where many women give birth at home without a trained birth attendant present. And she won't get emergency obstetric care that she needs. She won't get a C-section that she needs to relieve the obstruction. So what happens is after a prolonged period of being in labor, the woman can develop a fistula. And a fistula is a hole in the birth canal that causes chronic incontinence. So the woman most often loses her child. And in over 90% of the cases, the child is stillborn. And then she's also left with this devastating physical injury, which leaves her incontinent, which is also incredibly psychologically damaging and challenging because of the stigma and the smell that goes along with the incontinence.
How does treatment of fistula, how does that change a woman's life?
Fistula treatment is one of the most transformative surgeries that you can provide to a woman. She's lived often for many years or even decades, socially isolated from her community, from her family. Many women end up being divorced by their husbands once they develop a fistula because they're not able to have sexual relations or they are leaking urine and they're smelling, so the husband might run away or abandon them. They had no idea that this treatment was even possible. They thought that they did something wrong, that they were cursed. And so being able to show them that this is a medical condition, that it's treatable, is absolutely life-transforming and life-changing.
Included in your fistula treatment network, you all are also sharing the information with men. How do men respond to this?
It's essential that we include men also in our outreach activities and sensitize them to the work that we're doing. Men are key decision makers in the context we're working in Kenya, and it's critical to have their support both in helping their wives or their sisters or their mothers coming in for surgery. And it's also key that once the women return back to their communities, that men are aware that this is a medical condition. It's not a curse or something that their wife has done wrong. And really involving them in the process is really key to a smooth transition in and out of the communities. And it's also key to involve men because they often are respected elders and respected members and religious leaders in society. So involving them is helping us sort of spread the message that fistula is both preventable and treatable.
You mentioned moving on to other countries with your program. So how soon will you be doing this and what countries are you looking at next?
We are very excited. This model that's never really been done before, sort of linking together treatment centers across the country and with help from our funder, Astellas Pharma EMEA, we've really been able to do that in a way that I don't think we anticipated the success. We're really looking at taking this maybe to places in Southern Africa as well as Asia. So we have a great team that's sort of putting our heads together and seeing where we can go next.
That was Lindsay Palasik, Program Director for Action on Fistula in Kenya. She spoke with me from Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A fresh wave of violence in the capital of the Central African Republic kills at least 36 people and displaces 30,000 more. The general who led a failed coup in Burkina Faso says he is willing to face justice for his actions. And the United Nations holds a high-level meeting on the migrant and refugee crisis. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda. And later, Malawi's president appeals for international help to cope with an expected food shortage in his country. I'm Kim Lewis with Yuhaya Spuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with the Rugby World Cup.
Kim, South Africa's head coach, Heineke Meyer, has named veteran scrum half Fourie de Vries as captain for Saturday's Rugby World Cup match against Scotland in Newcastle, England. De Vries replaces Jean de Villiers, who returned home after breaking his jaw September 26th in South Africa's 46-6 victory over Samoa. Coach Meyer, how would you describe your new captain?
You know, he's not a guy of a lot of words, not like me, but he's a true warrior, and that's what you're going to need. You know, it's no use. We've been under the pressure since day one in the championship, so the players respect him. Usually when he's on the field, he's a natural leader and take leadership, you know, it comes naturally to him. So we need that on the field. He knows what I want on the field. He knows what's the right calls. And the biggest thing is he knows how to win.
Coach Meyer says the Springboks of South Africa, two-time world champions, will need to build on their win over Samoa after being upset by Japan in their opening match to stay on course for the quarterfinals. Turning to African football, the Lone Star of Liberia is the biggest mover in the October FIFA rankings. Liberia jumped 65 places to number 95 overall in the rankings released Thursday. Liberia's big move comes after a 1-0 victory over Tunisia last month in a 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier. South Sudan and Central African Republic also made big jumps in the October rankings after scoring victories last month in Nations Cup qualifiers. South Sudan rose 54 places to number 144 overall. South Sudan defeated Equatorial Guinea last month 1-0 in Juba, a victory described as the biggest victory in South Sudan's young footballing history. And Central African Republic jumped 42 places in the October FIFA rankings to number 126 overall. CAR beat the Democratic Republic of Congo 2-0 last month in Bangui. Taking a quick look at the top 10 African teams, according to FIFA, Algeria is number one on the continent and 19th overall. Ivory Coast is at 21, neighbor Ghana at 25, and Tunisia at 36. Senegal is at 38 overall. The Cape Verde Islands is 41. Cameroon is at 48. Congo Brazzaville at 49. Egypt at 51. And Nigeria at 52. And taking a look at the very top of the FIFA October rankings, Argentina is number one, followed by Germany, Belgium, Portugal, and Colombia. Our VOA football fans will remember top-ranked Argentina lost to Germany 1-0 in extra time in the 2014 World Cup final in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, let's turn to the CAF Confederation Cup tournament now. I remember you sticking your neck out on the Voice of America and predicting an all-Egyptian final. Well, that prediction looks in jeopardy right now, David, based on the results from the weekend. Orlando Pirates 1, Al Ahly of Egypt 0. That match played at Orlando Stadium in South Africa. And Etoile Sahel of Tunisia, 5. Zamalek of Egypt, 1. That match played in Tunisia. Your thoughts on those two games, David?
Sonny, I was hoping you wouldn't mention those predictions I made. All I can say in my defense, Chief Justice Sonny Young, is I certainly was not the only one. We didn't have egg on our faces. We had literally omelette. Sonny, this is, I think in all the years I've covered African football, this is one of the most amazing results. I've also had to watch the Rugby World Cup, and the first glimpse I got of the scoreline from this Zamalek Etoile game was 3-1 to Etoile. And I said to myself, now the Egyptians will fight back, and it'll be much closer at the end. The next time I looked, Sonny, it was 4-1, and the third time I looked, it was 5-1. And that is, I don't know what word to use, sensational, stunning, staggering, and absolutely amazing result. I mean, let's just contextualize this in my defense, having predicted that Zamalek would reach the final. Zamalek, in their 3 away group matches, they only conceded 3 goals. So they averaged a goal a game in the group stage. Now suddenly they concede 5 in one game. Etoile, on the other hand, they scored 4 goals in 3 home matches at the group stage. Now in one match, they eclipsed that figure and scored 5. It was an amazing, amazing result. I guess the most stunned people after this match were probably the Tunisians themselves. I don't think if you said before the game to them, you're going to win 5-1, they would have just laughed at you and said, we'll settle for a 1-goal victory. It all began, Sonny, as it often does in these sort of occasions, with an early goal. And it was Tej after just 5 minutes. Bounedja, a name that we keep mentioning on the sunny side of sport, he's an Algerian, and he's a regular goal scorer in the CAF Confederation Cup this year. He got the second after 11 minutes, but then Hefni halved that deficit with a goal for Zamalek. So after 25 minutes, it was back to 2-1 for Etoile. But the next goal from Brigao after 35 minutes gave the Tunisians a 3-1 halftime lead. And that is the way the scoreline remained until 7 minutes from the end, when Tej, who I'm sure the Zamalek team don't want to see again for an awful long time, he scored his 2nd goal of the match and the 4th for the Tunisians. And then, Sonny, the goal that perhaps has really now put this tie beyond the reach of Zamalek came from a defender, Ben Aziza, after 87 minutes. Now, what does 5-1 mean? Well, first of all, it's the first time since 1987 that Zamalek has conceded 5 goals in a CAF club match. On that occasion, it was away to Ashanti Kotoko of Ghana. And now what Zamalek need to do is they need to win 4-0 at home. That would give them victory on the away goals rule. The coach says it's possible. Jesualdo Ferreira, he's a Portuguese person. I guess, Sonny, that's what he would inevitably have to say. And it's not impossible, but I think it is extremely unlikely. I think Etoile now have got the bit between their teeth. They know that they've got at least 1 foot in the final. And I think they also know if they can just score 1 goal in Cairo, they'll be well on their way to the final. So that prediction of mine, Sonny, yeah, it's looking extremely shaky at the moment. The other one, Sonny, is in balance. At least I've got a chance with Al Ahly, I think. A very close first match in Soweto, a bit of a dour struggle, and it was decided by an early goal from Gabuza. He flicked the ball past the Krami in the Ahly goal after just 9 minutes. Pirates coach Eric Tinkler was reasonably satisfied. He said he wanted a win, and crucially, he didn't want to concede a goal at home. And on those two counts, he can tick the boxes. But deep down, I'm sure he was hoping for maybe a 2nd goal. So this tie is in the balance. The return match is in Suez, which is just east of Cairo, Sunday. And here, Sonny, I think the crucial factor is going to be the away goal. If Pirates can score an away goal, that means Ahly would have to score 3 goals. And I think then the South Africans can get through. But on the other hand, Ahly, it's not the first time they faced this sort of a challenge, a 1-0 deficit. And if they score even 1 goal to win 1-0, it would go to a penalty shootout where the Egyptians are normally very cool, calm and collected. So we've got a fascinating situation. We've got the tie between Zamalek and Etoile, which to all intents and purposes looks like it's done and dusted. That return match is Saturday in Cairo. And then on Sunday, Sonny, very much in the balance, an intriguing tie between Pirates and Athlete. Obviously, my heart must be with the Pirates, but I fear the worst, Sonny, if it's a Pirates at 12 final, you'll be reminding me for the next 6 weeks that I got not only Zamalek wrong, but also Athlete wrong. I'm not sure I can live up to that, Sonny.
All right, thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Hi, I'm Shegwa Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Let me give a few Sunny Side of Sports UEFA Champions League shout-outs now for Portuguese star Cristiano Ronaldo, who scored the 500th and 501st goals of his career to give Real Madrid a 2-0 victory over Malmö of Sweden. Real Madrid also says Ronaldo scored his 323rd and 324th goals for the club, overtaking Raul as the club's all-time top scorer. UEFA, however, says Raul and Ronaldo are still level at 323. Another shout-out for Spanish midfielder Juan Mata, who scored one goal and set up another as host Manchester United came from behind to beat Wolfsburg 2-1. Another shout-out for Argentina's Sergio Aguero, who scored a last-minute penalty as the other club in Manchester, Manchester City, came back from a goal down to snatch a dramatic 2-1 victory at Borussia Mönchengladbach in Germany. And one more shout-out for Ivorian striker Seydou Doumbia, who had two goals to help CSKA Moscow beat visiting PSV Eindhoven 3-2. Doumbia delivering for CSKA Moscow. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Malawi's president's appeal for international help to cope with an expected food shortage in its country. And next, smallholder farmers in remote parts of Tanzania in the middle of a global ideological war over land ownership. But first, some music. Here is Mani Martin of Rwanda with Umar Arunga.
Abandu amagana na magana, bose baba amagana, bose baba bachaka bute, ngovale bumu mararungu, ngovale bumu mararungu, bumu mararungu, na we. Shakuba yaraha ungobumandi Uwo 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 mumararungu Nawe yavuta Avarusha kuba yarahubwo bumanzi na rurema yabayo ba abandu amagana na mama Koste baba bachaka bute ngobale
Manny Martin of Rwanda with Umararungu.
Malawi's President Peter Mutharika has appealed for international help to cope with an expected food shortage that could affect 17% of the country's population during the coming months. VOA's Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In his national address on the food situation, Mutharika said people in 25 of the country's 28 districts are at risk of hunger.
Total of 2,833,212 people will not be able to meet their annual food requirement. In view of this, I'd like to appeal to all development assistance partners, other countries, non-government organizations, both in Malawi and elsewhere, to complement government resources in assisting the food insecure households.
Mutharika said an updated national food assessment will be released in mid-October by the Malawi Vulnerability Assessment Committee.
Based on the historical trend, that assessment is likely to show a larger number of people facing hunger than is now the case.
Mutharika said Malawi needs about $150 million to attend to those in need of food assistance. The food deficit is a result of low yields of the main staple maize, largely because of recent flooding, which damaged at least 64,000 hectares of crop fields, mostly in southern Malawi. It is estimated that an additional 120,000 metric tons of maize will be needed to support the affected people. Mutharika said Malawi currently has purchased 30,000 metric tons from Zambia. The National Food Reserve Agency also said it was purchasing maize from Kenya. But analyst Rafiki Hajat of the Institute for Policy Interaction told VOA Area that past experience shows maize imports are not necessarily a means to avert a hunger situation.
We had a drought situation here in 1999 and in the year 2000, 42,000 people died, not because there was no maize, but because the price of maize was inflated by over 100% and they couldn't afford the maize.
Meanwhile, Malawi's national grain market has increased the price of maize in its depots by 5%, a move many feel will affect the buying power of poorer Malawians who need the foodstuff. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Scientists say demographic changes are affecting rice, rising population growth, urbanization, and land reform. Parkar Stad, the tough-talking executive chairman of Eco Energy, recently met with reporters in Dar es Salaam. He expressed his support for using the private sector to boost food production. But opponents have made a stand in Africa, and now poor smallholder farmers in remote parts of Tanzania are in the middle of a global ideological war over land ownership. From Dar es Salaam, Ruben Chama reports.
Eco Energy is among several transnational corporations that have come to invest in large-scale agriculture in the East African nation through a public-private partnership initiative. The initiative, called the Southern Agricultural Corridor of Tanzania, SAGOT, is being implemented in an area covering the size of Italy. It's part of the G7's new Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, which aims to generate greater private investment for agriculture, scale up innovation, achieve sustainable food security, and reduce poverty and end hunger. Carsten, the executive chairman of Eco Energy, says time has come for Tanzania, a country of 53 million people, to transform its agriculture to create jobs and support economic growth before a crisis hits.
If the population expects to grow more than 2.5 times in the next 40 years in Africa, Tanzania, where we are now, expects to grow 3 times. A lot of things you see here in Tanzania, how to handle land, for example, is based on when there were 15 million people, like in the mid-60s and the late 60s. If you're not able to provide jobs and opportunities for them in the future, it's a social, it's a ticking bomb. We need 60% more food on this planet within the next 4 or 5 years.
He said that Africa, the world's poorest continent, needed to borrow a leaf from Brazil, the world's largest exporter of sugar, after it transformed its agriculture sector to large-scale farming.
I lived 4 years in Brazil, and you see in the latitude, these are the same natural conditions. The question is, how come can Africa be the biggest importer of sugar and ethanol and fuel, while if you take Brazil, it's exporting 50% of the world supply? And why is it not possible to replicate a similar kind of development here?
But now poor smallholder farmers are siding with opponents to corporate investment in large-scale agriculture. For example, the Swedish-owned company plans to set up a sugarcane plantation in Razaba village in northeastern Tanzania's Bagamoyo district. But there is a simmering standoff resulting to unending discussions around compensation. As a result, the project is 4 years late in getting started. Although Eco Energy has consulted villagers in Bagamoyo, a recent study by Aid refused that majority of the local small-scale farmers have not been offered choice of whether to be resettled or not. The report alleges that they have also not been given crucial information about the irreversible effects of the project on their livelihoods and food sovereignty. Local farmers, too, agreed with the sentiments raised by the ActionAid report and expressed fear of a loss of prime land and failure by the authorities to engage them in the process. Nawahi Nawahi, a 59-year-old father of four, said the confusion surrounding the land acquisition process has disrupted the normal way of life among the local farmers.
Mazao mengi ameshakufa kufa umamna kwa sasa hivi ndio hata kupanda tupande ndio baadaye hiyo tafini.
A lot of the food crops and produce have dried up. There is nothing here.
Kulikuwa na michungwa huko, kulikuwa na mipera na wao katika revision hiyo waliona katika ule usajili. Waliona.
Here we used to have citrus fruits, guavas, and they themselves saw that. Nawahi used to cultivate maize, beans, pawpaws, cassava and vegetables in 4 out of his 6 acre piece of land. Tanzanian officials clarified that the Bagamoyo project is a special case and that the land belonged to the government. Dr. Moses Kusiluka, the commissioner for lands, said the site was initially earmarked as a ranch for livestock keeping before it was abandoned.
The Eco Energy Farm in Bagamoyo is a farm that is owned by the government. It has a title deed. It belongs to the government. So that's not village land. Initially, it used to be a ranch for cattle keeping. But after some time, sort of abandoned. And there were some people who moved in the farm. They established some settlements. So when that farm was to be used by a large investor, it was necessary to remove these people by paying them some compensation, because the law would always say, oh, these people have been living there for quite some time.
Amid the uncertainties that have hampered the implementation of the Bagamoyo sugarcane plantation project, a group of smallholder farmers in Morogoro, some 170 kilometers west of Dar es Salaam, have offered a ray of hope. They have adopted eco-friendly farming practices that promise higher yields and income. Pius Paulini, secretary of the Maendeleo Farmers Group, said through the support of a non-governmental organization funded by BioVision Foundation, a Swiss-based non-profit, the farmers have been able to transform their livelihoods.
Kikundi hiki kilianza mwaka 2010 na tulipata mafunzo kutoka shirika la SAT, Sustainable Agriculture Tanzania.
We formed this farmers group in the year 2010. We received training from a local NGO, Sustainable Agriculture Tanzania, SAT. Like majority of his contemporaries, the 50-year-old father of four used to practice conventional farming, where intensive use of synthetic fertilizers is pronounced. However, poor harvest and greater challenges such as climate change and soil erosion prompted him to intensify terracing, use of compost manure, and irrigation. Leading experts gave a ringing endorsement to organic farming, citing research findings that revealed its profound impact on food security and smallholders' income. Reporting for VOA News, this is Ruben Chama from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Trade and Development Agency awarded a grant on September 25th to NextGen Solawazi Limited to support the development of a 60-megawatt solar photovoltaic power plant in Shinyanga, a city in northwestern Tanzania. The grant supports a feasibility study that will evaluate the technical and commercial viability of the power plant, conduct environmental and social impact assessments, and provide the necessary analysis for NextGen Solawazi to seek implementation financing. This project is critically important to Tanzania's economic growth as, according to the World Bank, only 15% of its population has access to electricity. USTDA is pleased to continue our work with NextGen Solawazi to develop renewable energy in Tanzania, said Director Leocadia Zak, who signed the grant agreement along with NextGen Solawazi Limited Managing Director Mayank Bargava. This project presents a valuable opportunity to draw upon U.S. technical expertise to deploy new energy generation capacity in Shinyanga. Tanzania's National Strategy for Poverty Reduction and Growth has identified limited power generation capacity and poor electricity access as the most critical issue for development, said Mr. Bargava. Energy generation from the solar plant will not only electrify an estimated 210,000 households, but also act as a catalyst to attract other commercial enterprises by providing reliable, plentiful, and cheaper electricity. The feasibility study will be undertaken by U.S. engineering and technical consulting company Clean Energy Consulting and Education in Phoenix, Arizona. The project builds upon the agency's previous collaboration with NextGen Solawazi, including the provision of an owner's engineer who is supporting efforts to build a 5-megawatt solar plant in Kigoma, Tanzania. Both of these projects advance the goals of Power Africa, a U.S. government-led initiative to add cleaner, more efficient electricity generation capacity across the subcontinent. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Tanzania, to help provide clean, safe, and renewable energy to meet the needs of a growing and vibrant population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.